Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of President Taco to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the argument from outdated data.
Yeah.
I particularly like President Taco because taco is a Mexican thing.
Absolutely.
It really gets under his skin.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
And just in case anyone is not aware, it is a reference by a Financial Times reporter to a thing that's been happening with the stock market where people are, it's basically called taco trades, where people are buying when Trump's tariffs make the stock market crash and then selling when he chickens out and pulls back the tariffs and the stock market recovers. And so it's taco stands for Trump always chickens out. Because you can rely on the fact that he will be a
on
pussy.
The fact that he will just backtrack on it,
when the stock market drops because of a stupid tariff idea he has.
There you go. And he loves the fact that people call him chicken. He hates. He really, can't stand it. Really.
He's basically Marty McFly.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the argument from outdated data. This is an episode which is a multiple of 11, and these are the ones where we talk about new fallacies that have not previously appeared in the old lists of fallacies. And almost always, I think, and in fact, every time up until now, it's been one that we have identified. This one is not, and more about that later.
Oh.
Meanwhile, what it is it refers to a situation where someone is providing evidence for their claim, but the evidence they provide is out of date. It's something which maybe was true at some point or was widely believed, certainly, but has since been superseded, debunked, replaced with much more robust or reliable data.
Or even just more recent data.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They're ignoring that more up-to-date stuff and going with the outdated stuff that fits their claim, arguably provides evidence for their claim when it isn't necessarily the best information they could be using. So our first example comes from the debate between Trump and Hillary Clinton in 2016. But this is one of many, many times he's made this same kind of exact claim.
In Chicago, which has the toughest gun laws in the United States, probably you could say by far, they have more gun violence than any other city.
So he rolls this claim out anytime he's asked about gun control.
Yeah.
Which is quite often. And he says, basically, you know, clearly gun control doesn't work because Chicago has the toughest gun laws of any city. And look at the violence in Chicago. It's the worst anywhere.
Yeah.
This is basically outdated data because what he's referring to with Chicago's gun laws was once kind of true. Certainly, arguably, was one of the toughest cities in the nation in terms of gun laws, because in 1982, they banned handguns in Chicago. There was only one other place which banned handguns, and that was D.C. And in 2008, there was a Supreme Court case called D.C. versus Heller, which ruled the D.C. handgun law unconstitutional. So handguns were then allowed in D.C. And 2 years later, in 2010, that was widened out to include Chicago as well, which was the only other place that banned handguns, with the McDonald versus City of Chicago decision. So that meant that then you were allowed to have handguns in Chicago. There's still a gun dealer licensing law in the city of Chicago. There aren't any gun dealers in the city itself. There are gun dealers elsewhere in Illinois, and you can get guns from neighboring states and other places. The Trace Project, which checks where guns come from that are used in crimes, found that after McDonald versus City of Chicago and being allowed to have guns in Chicago, over the next 5 years, 60% of the guns that were recovered by police or seized by police were actually originally from Indiana and neighbouring states.
Yeah.
So they weren't even ones that had been bought in Illinois. The law continued to change. In 2013, Illinois became the last state in the US to adopt concealed carry. So you are allowed to carry a concealed handgun in Chicago now, and that's just one of your Second Amendment rights. So in fact, now there are probably 8 or 9 major cities that have much stricter gun laws than Chicago.
Wow. Yeah.
And the other thing that goes along with what Trump is saying about the violence, gun violence, apparently, according to him and his data, is linked to gun laws and how that gun laws don't work. That's also kind of out of date, but in a different way, in a way, in the opposite way, because the gun violence that you're seeing is recent in Chicago. When guns weren't allowed, there wasn't.
There wasn't. That was my question. That was my question. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there actually a direct causal connection between fewer guns and fewer gun crime?
It made a truly demonstrable change.
Yeah.
Because it's true to say that the pure number of gun-related violent incidents in Chicago, in 2016, for example, which was when this clip was from, was the highest of any major city. But Chicago's a big place. It's one of the biggest cities in the US.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the murder rate, you know, that's the number of murders per 100,000 people, for example. In 2016, you're looking at a murder rate of 27.9 in Chicago, 27.9 murders per 100,000 people during that year. That's half of St. Louis, which was 59.3. So St. Louis had a smaller number of actual murders, because it's a smaller city, but the rate was twice as high as Chicago.
Right, yeah.
If you look back to when the guns were not as easily available, in 2010, Chicago's murder rate was only 16.1 out of 100,000.
Wow.
That wasn't even in the top 10 of major cities in terms of murder rate.
Wow.
So when you make guns harder to get hold of, there are less violent incidents involving guns and less gun homicides. Yeah. When they become easier to get hold of... Those rates go up.
He's basically comparing apples and oranges, both of which are out of date. So he's got past the sell-by date apples and not fit to eat oranges.
He's relating 15-year-old gun laws with current violence levels. I suppose it was like 6 or 7 years old at the time, but he's still doing it. He rolled it out this year.
It would be legitimate if you're looking at the 15-year-old data to say, 15 years ago, the gun laws were the strictest. And at that time, that meant, therefore, that the gun-related crimes were also very low.
Certainly, compared to how they are now.
Part of the appeal is the authority of the data and ignoring the fact that the data's been superseded.
So our second example is kind of representative of what a lot of people have said, but this is Trump saying it about Fauci.
The CDC says if everybody wore a mask for 4 to 6 weeks, we could get this under control. Do you regret not wearing a mask in public from the start? And would you consider, will you consider a national mandate that people need to wear masks?
No, I want people to have a certain freedom, and I don't believe in that, no. And I don't agree with the statement that if everybody wear a mask, everything disappears. Hey, Dr. Fauci said don't wear a mask. Our Surgeon General, terrific guy, said don't wear a mask. Everybody was saying don't wear a mask. All of a sudden, everybody's got to wear a mask. And as you know, masks cause problems, too. With that being said, I'm a believer in masks. I think masks are good. But I leave it up to the governors.
He's citing Fauci as an authority on saying you don't need to wear masks. And this is what a lot of mask skeptics did. This interview was from July of 2020. And, you know, there was obviously a push from the media to say masks are now considered the thing that everyone should be doing. Why are you not promoting it? Why are you not telling people to wear masks? Why are you not having, you know, requiring mask mandates? And you're not, you know, going out in public wearing a mask yourself. His response was, Fauci said not to wear masks. And that's what a lot of people said. There was an Instagram post in June 2021 because there was a Freedom of Information request that resulted in a lot of Fauci's emails from early on in the pandemic being released. And one of the things that came out was an email that he had sent to Sylvia Burwell, who was a former head of the Department of Health and Human Services, who asked him if she should wear a mask when she was going travelling, basically. And he replied, masks are really for infected people to prevent them from spreading infection to people who are not infected, rather than protecting uninfected people from acquiring infection. The typical mask you buy in the drugstore is not really effective in keeping out virus, which is small enough to pass through the material. It might provide some slight benefit to keep out gross droplets if someone coughs or sneezes on you. I do not recommend that you wear a mask, particularly since you're going to a very low-risk location. And this was held up by people in 2021 as evidence that Fauci was lying.
Right.
He knew early on that masks don't do anything, and any time he said you should wear a mask, he was just lying.
Yeah,
and it was a method of controlling the population and scaring people. But the thing is, this email was from the 5th of February, 2020, which is 2 weeks after the first case in the US. There was almost no information.
Yeah.
The other thing at the time was, to the extent that they were aware that masks would help already infected symptomatic people from spreading the disease to other people, the best place to use that was in hospitals. And there was a limited number of masks at the time. He was going off the best medical information he had at the time, 2 weeks into a pandemic, and also arguably in an effort to maintain the PPE for the people who it would be most effective in helping to keep doing their job, which was helping people who were sick.
Yep.
By April, the CDC was saying, we've learned lots of things about masks. One of the things they'd learned was that asymptomatic people were able to pass on COVID.
Right, yeah.
So that was part of why they hadn't previously said you should wear a mask just generally, because if you didn't know you had it and you were wearing a mask, then that would prevent you from passing it on. Yeah, they learnt a lot. Studies were done in the first 2 months. By the 3rd of April, Fauci was saying you should wear a mask. The CDC was saying you should wear a mask. And the reason they were doing that is because the science had been done that enabled them to make those determinations.
And also that there were no longer any place, or fewer, there were far fewer places that were safe to go to.
Yeah, yeah.
Where wearing a mask would be unnecessary. It became necessary to wear a mask because there were no safe places that if you were travelling, particularly on the train or on a plane.
And it fed into the narrative that you can't trust the science because the science keeps changing. You know, scientists keep changing their mind. And they change their mind because they do science. And the science tells them a thing they weren't previously aware of. So our final example in this section is an Elon Musk tweet that was actually a kind of, he quote tweeted a person called Libby Emmons, who posted a headline from the Las Vegas Review Journal from August of 2023. The headline was, "Retired police chief killed in bike crash, remembered for laugh, love of coffee." So she'd highlighted bike crash and said, just seeing this, how vile. And Elon quote tweeted that and said, an innocent man was murdered in cold blood while riding his bicycle. The killers joked about it on social media. Yet where is the media outrage? Now you begin to understand the lie. What he's referring to is that this retired police chief had been a victim of murder, basically, by a couple of underage teens who were driving a car and they deliberately targeted him on his bike, drove into the back of his bike, left him for dead. They had filmed it and posted it on social media. And it was a big scandal and very bad thing. And they got arrested.
Yep.
This isn't, however, the newspapers not reporting crime against white men, which is how Elon and his followers saw it.
Right,
one person who replied to Elon said, the media seems to underreport wrong to white males. They seem more likely to express outrage if a marginalized group is targeted. I don't think it's my imagination. And Elon replied, 1,000%. And the thing is that this case happened in early August of 2023. The article that was screenshotted was from August 18th. The video of the cyclist being hit by the car was obtained by police on August 29th, and on August 31st, there was a new article clarifying that the driver had intentionally hit the cyclist and police chief. So before this tweet from the middle of September of 2023, there was updated information, and the headlines in the newspapers that were reporting on this case were talking about it as a homicide.
Right.
But yep. they had specifically gone back to an early version of the story where they didn't have the information about that. And all they knew was that he was found on the side of the road having been in a crash.
So where is the media outrage? Well, there was
media outrage. Media outrage happened after they knew what had happened to him.
In the gap, in the gap, in the 17 days before you posted that stuff, you could have looked anywhere and there would have been outrage. You know, now you begin to understand the lie. Well, we have understood the lie, Elon, because what you're doing is cherry-picking the past.
Good alternative name for this fallacy, cherry-picking the past, because that's specifically what's happening, is they are choosing a moment in history where the thing they're saying might have been true based on the evidence.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
Well, just one example today, because it was a glaring one that occurred very recently, was, not unsurprisingly, Nigel Farage, who's currently on a campaign to park his tanks on the lawns of the left wing as well as the lawns of the right wing. Part of the problem is that the media seem to be giving him a lot of airtime, given that he's got five MPs. People are leaving Reform left, right and centre. More about that later. But the latest attack on wokery is this current thing that he said the other day.
If we win the next election, we will scrap net zero, something that is costing the Exchequer an extraordinary £40 billion plus pounds every year.
You can speak like that as much as you like, Farage. It doesn't make it any more true. Because in a post on Blue Sky, following that, like a couple of hours later, Jill Rutter, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for Government, said that, because she wrote the fucking report, said that Farage's figures came from a 2021 report by the Institute for Government, which was citing numbers that they got in working with the Climate Change Committee, the CCC. And the 2021 report had argued that investment, both from public and private sectors, to around $5 billion per year by the end of the decade to meet the previous government's, who were the Tories, slightly less ambitious net zero target. So the Tories wound it down a bit. There was a report done in 2021. Labour followed that report and adopted that as a good thing. However, much to the dismay of many left-wing voters, in February 2024, Labour ditched this planned £28 billion a year. Their spending pledge was announced in 2021 following that report. It's been a key part of their plans to reach climate targets, secure green jobs, replace our dependence on imported fossil fuels, etc., etc., etc. Labour already admitted by then that the green plans weren't really £28 billion, but they were £20 billion because the government, the Tory party, was already spending £8 billion. On the 8th of February 24, they shrank the commitment from £20 billion to $4.7 billion. And even when Starmer explained it, then he came under attack from the opposition party.
The reason for that is because since we announced the $28 billion, the Tories have done terrible damage to our economy, not just the Liz Truss budget, but also now the government briefing that it's going to max out on the government credit card. Reckless, but I have to anticipate the circumstances as they are now, not as I'd wish them to be.
This was the flagship plank of Labour's economic policy, and it now looks like he's trying to wriggle out of it. I think it demonstrates exactly what I've been saying, that he U-turns on major things. He can't say what he would do differently because he doesn't have a plan.
Interestingly, the Tories' current stance is that net zero is too expensive. So there's Starmer saying net zero is too expensive because there's a massive hole in the economy. And the Tories, and having Rishi Sunak having said, yeah, they've said that, it was great, now they've U-turned, the Tories are now saying pretty much what Farage is saying. They're not going just as outrageously with that because they know that they will lose the green vote. Thatcher once described the Tories as the truly green party. So Farage's numbers cherry-picked the original report, which stressed that most of the money would come from the private sector, not public funds. So he kind of plucks this figure out of the thing, and you can find that figure in that report.
So the 40 billion is in the original IFG report, is it?
Yeah.
Because it went down to 5 and then back up to 28 and then down to 20 and then down to almost 5 again.
But it's 5 a year, so it's 40 billion overall over the...
Right, but he says an extraordinary 40 billion plus every year.
Yeah.
So that... Yeah. Was that ever true?
No.
Or was it... So that was 40 billion over the course of 8 years? It was,
yes. Yeah.
Right. So he was wrong in the first place, but it was based on a real figure.
outdated data, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's data that existed then... It's still probably true that that's what you've got to spend, but it isn't true that Labour are going to spend it.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a great investment if they were to spend that money. It would be a great use of that kind of money, because it's a,
absolutely,
frankly, as in the cost of running a government, it's a piddling amount of money
like
to do something incredibly important.
Yes.
But they're still not going to do it.
No. And the thing is that in the report, it says even before you count the benefits of going to the green and all of the things that were informing the previous Labour policy, the economy itself will be as big in April 2051. So this is, you know, if you get to net zero 2050 was the target. The economy would be as big in April 2051 if net zero delivered as it would have been in December 2050.
Right.
So the lag between recouping the costs by investing now and not investing now and saving all that money, the lag would only be 4 months.
Yeah.
And also, the when he says it's costing 40 billion a year, the latest, most recent accounts from the Department of Energy Security and Net Zero shows that they only spent 1 billion on taking action on climate change.
Jesus Christ.
So, yeah.
Memories light the corners of my mind. Misty bias confirmed memories of the truths that weren't. Taters, verifiable, and yet what doesn't fit our standpoint, we simply choose to forget. So it's all data. We will remember whenever we remember the way things were. The way things were.
Perry Como there, of course, with The Way We Were.
Excellent. Love that film. In The Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example this week is a little bit different, because as I mentioned in the intro, I didn't identify this fallacy. And so our first clip is me talking to the man who did. I'm joined today by Jonathan Jarry. He's a science communicator from McGill University's Office for Science and Society. And for 10 years, he was the co-host of the excellent Body of Evidence podcast. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So this week, we're talking about the appeal to outdated data And that's actually a fallacy that you identified. I know it was a couple of years ago now, but from what you can remember, can you tell us how that came about?
Sure. So here's what I remember. So it was about 2022, I think. And so Dr. Christopher Labos and I had this podcast, A Body of Evidence, and we did a string of episodes on cholesterol myths, sort of looking at the evidence behind good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, what's good for your health, what is not, and the role of statins, which are medications that will lower your cholesterol. And in a bonus episode for our patrons, so this is a very, very deep cut, we went over some more, so because, I mean, Chris could talk about statins and cholesterol for hours and hours, so I had to rein him in. But there were a few questions that had not been addressed in the main episodes, and one of them was this claim that statins had never been studied in women, or that their worth or benefits had never been demonstrated in women, only in men, which was a very peculiar argument. It's something that some of Chris's own patients would tell him when he would say, hey, I want to prescribe a statin for you based on your test results. It's an interesting argument because it's something that used to be true, but that isn't anymore. So before the 1990s, I believe, studies of statins had only been done in men. And this is a problem that we see in the biomedical sciences in general, which is that a lot of like old trials would only recruit men, especially white men. And that has changed since then. And so, of course, this is not true anymore. There have been modern randomized controlled trials of statins involving women. And as Chris was saying in the episode, when you break it down by sex, there are clear benefits for statins for women as well. And so I thought this was an interesting argument because I'd never really thought of this as a bad argument per se. And so I kind of struggled to figure out what kind of fallacious argument this was. Is this a strawman argument? What is this? And it really is an argument from outdated data or an appeal to outdated data where, you know, you could sort of maliciously use that because you don't like the conclusion otherwise, but you can also just repeat that out of sheer ignorance because not everybody keeps up with the body of evidence on a particular topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I suppose people could also, when looking at different studies, confirmation bias might kind of lead them to believe the ones that agree with them, even if they're older or perhaps less robust studies.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, motivated reasoning is a powerful drug. And and there are so many studies out there that you can find a study that will confirm your pre-existing beliefs and sort of shun the ones that you don't like, that disagree with your prior conclusion. So yeah, it is very easy to dig into the biomedical literature with a conclusion already in mind and just find the papers that support your position and reject the ones that don't.
And given the replication crisis of what seems to be established science not necessarily being replicated or being upheld later on, and science changing, because that's what science does, it's how science works, is this something you see other times in your science communication work? Are people referring back to what seem to be established views but have since been either debunked or not replicated?
I think so. I mean, I couldn't give you a clear example of that outside of the cholesterol statin debate sort of off the top of my head. But yeah, I mean, and there are similar arguments that are being made that we will get to where, you know, you're not dealing with somebody who has a full understanding of where we are scientifically right now.
Sure. Something I see from time to time from a kind of psychology point of view is the backfire effect. People talking about,
yes,
if you try and persuade someone else of their opinions, that they become more entrenched. And that was absolutely an established belief among psychology researchers, and it has since been completely failed to be replicated. But people will still make that argument.
Yeah, I remember sort of after the backfire effect had been mostly debunked, involving the original team that found it, and they tried to replicate this, and it just didn't replicate. And I was on a panel at a science communication conference in Montreal, and one of the questions that I got was about this backfire effect, and I was able to tell this person, like, no, you don't have to worry about this. Yes, I know this was a thing a few years ago. We were all sort of very deeply worried about this, but no, this effect has not really replicated. Maybe it does exist in very specific circumstances, but this is not this sort of widely witnessed phenomenon that we were afraid it was.
Yeah. So you alluded to another related fallacy that you've also identified. So tell us about that one.
Yeah, so the square one fallacy, that is something that is basically at the center of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Department of Health and Human Services right now, and at the center of the MAHA movement. I was giving a talk recently, and there was an anti-vaxxer in the audience who, of course, would not identify as such. He was just asking questions. And we had a chat afterwards, and it was very interesting to me because a lot of the arguments he was making were simply not true, because we had studies on this, but he kept saying, we don't have studies on this, has never been studied before. And he was clearly repeating talking points from the anti-vaccine movement, of which Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a massive leader, right? So he's had a huge influence on how people discuss vaccines. And on the spot right there, I said, well, this sounds to me like something that I would call the square one fallacy. It sounds like you're saying that we're starting from square one, that we have no data on the safety of, for instance, the COVID-19 vaccines, which is not true. We have studies on this, and we have studies on the putative link between the MMR vaccine and autism. We have a ton of data on this. But he was behaving as if these things had never been studied. And so isn't this a great thing that RFK Jr. is coming into the White House and now he will fund studies on this? So I did a bit of a Google search to see if this was a fallacy that had been named before. And I could only find one reference to this in somebody's thesis from something like 20 years ago. And so I wrote an article about this because I think that this is a very important fallacy, and it has ties to the appeal to outdated data, because that appeal is basically saying, well, we have some data, but we don't have the data that we're looking for right now for this particular subgroup, let's say. Well, the square one fallacy is saying, well, we have no data at all on this question, and so we need to do studies on this. And just like with the appeal to outdated data, you can make this argument in a malicious way because you have an agenda, but you can also make it out of ignorance because this is what you've been told and you haven't looked to see if the studies do exist.
Absolutely. So I think we will definitely be looking at that in a later episode. So, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining me. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
So the work that I do is for the McGill Office for Science and Society, and we publish new articles every week. You can find them at mcgill.ca/OSS. And if people want to see me on social media, they will have to join Blue Sky, which is a wonderful social media platform. They can just search for my name on Blue Sky.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
I really liked his spin on the RFK Jr. stance of the, what did he call it? The back to square one.
Square one fallacy. Yeah.
Yeah. That is the extreme version of this fallacy, is not just to return to old data, but to return to a time before the data was gathered.
Yeah, pretend that it doesn't exist at all.
Because all of the data runs counter to your standpoint.
Because you're
so
wrong.
You've got to go to a time when it didn't exist. Yeah.
Yeah. So we will definitely be doing that perhaps in 11 episodes time. But there was another thing actually that we didn't talk about in that patron episode of Body of Evidence that Christopher Labos talked about with statins, was that one of the things that he hears time and time again is people saying, oh, it's just big pharma. They're just pushing statins because statins don't work. Right. So it's just big pharma pushing because they're trying to make money.
Yeah.
And he pointed out that statins are old medicines. They're out of patent. So anyone can make statins reasonably cheaply. And the company that spent the money developing them doesn't get money for that.
So no point in them again, pushing them.
That might once have been true. It might have been that the companies that developed and spent millions of dollars putting the money into the research wanted to push those out to medical reps and doctors and say, this is a great thing that will really work and help people. Now, that's not a good argument. That's an out-of-date argument, because while it might have once been true, it certainly isn't true now because they're not making any money out of it.
Yes, exactly. But that, of course, that runs counter to, you know, the big pharma people. Yeah. You can't kind of go big out of copyright drug manufacturers.
Big generic.
Big generic. I think we need a t-shirt with that on.
Our next example is from an episode of Law and Order Special Victims Unit, and this is an episode called 41 Witnesses. And the situation is that a woman has been assaulted and, in fact, murdered in the courtyard of a big apartment building. There's lots of windows around the courtyard. And so they're trying to find witnesses to the assault and the murder.
Yep.
And no one is coming forward or claiming that they saw anything.
I mean, how many people face that courtyard?
This one says his window was closed. That one says she went to bed early.
The bystander effect. Sometimes the more witnesses, the less help.
So Olivia there talks about the bystander effect and says sometimes the more witnesses, the less help. And this is because Law and Order likes to do stories ripped from the headlines. They like to base their cases on real cases and just kind of change some names and some details, and then they get to talk about proper issues. This one wasn't exactly an up-to-date headline that they were talking about, because this episode is based on the murder of Kitty Genovese, which was from 1964.
Oh, wow.
And it was the origin story of the bystander effect, which is a psychological effect, which is that when you're in a situation where something happens and requires people to intervene, the more people there are around you who are not intervening, the less likely you are to intervene. Because you think, because everyone thinks someone else could do it. It's not my responsibility. Yep. There are other people who could do it. And this was a very strongly believed and, in fact, replicated in laboratory studies effect from the 60s. After the Kitty Genovese murder, through to like early 2000s.
Yeah.
I learnt it when I did psychology at uni. And what happened in 1964 was Kitty Genovese was a 28-year-old bartender in New York. She was raped and stabbed outside her apartment building in a courtyard with lots of windows around in the apartment building. The New York Times reported on that case 2 weeks after the murder. They told this story about the fact that there were lots of people in this apartment building who had seen what happened or heard what happened. And didn't, and no one called the police. She was being attacked for a period of time, and nothing happened. No one went for help. No one tried to assist her. No one called the police. They were saying, you know, what's wrong with people? Why is New York like this? Why are people generally like this, that they'll see this horrific thing happening and no one does anything about it?
And do nothing, yeah.
And psychologists took an interest in this, and they kind of theorized about people thinking, well, you know, there's other people who could do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did various experiments that involved getting a person and a number of Confederates who were with the psychologists. They'd make a situation happen like smoke coming from under a door when they were supposedly all sitting waiting to go in to do an experiment or do some kind of survey or something. And will they raise an alarm? Will they do anything about it? Will they check if there's a problem? And the conclusion they came to was that if you're in a group of people who aren't doing anything about it, you'll also be less likely to do anything about it. And the larger the group, the less likely you will feel any responsibility to do anything in a situation where something is happening. The problem is that the New York Times report of the Kitty Genovese murder was full of lies.
Oh.
What they actually found when people went back in the early 2000s and looked at this case and looked at the police reports, they found that there was actually no evidence that there were 38 witnesses or that the witnesses observed the murder, or indeed that they were inactive, that they didn't do anything. In fact, people did call the police. Of the 38 people who the police had questioned about it, most of them weren't aware that there had been an incident or that what the incident was. They had heard something, maybe, but thought it was people, you know, drunk people coming back late from a bar or whatever.
Yeah.
They hadn't known that it was a killing. There was one witness who was aware that she had been stabbed, and some people heard parts of things, but no individual was aware of the whole thing. No one knew that she'd been attacked and was screaming and was assaulted and was killed and all of that. So there was no one who was in that situation where they were aware that this thing had happened and didn't do anything about it. Someone did call the police. Someone went and when they heard someone in trouble in the courtyard, they went into the courtyard and found her and helped her and kind of cradled her until the ambulance came. There was someone who shouted at the assaulter, drove him away for a time at least. So when you actually look into the situation that drove psychological studies into this effect, you find that actually it doesn't hold up in the real world.
Wow.
People have since tried to replicate it in the real world, and they've looked at things that are outside of a lab situation. Yep. So there was a more recent study which looked at surveillance cameras of violent incidents in the real world in Amsterdam, Cape Town and Lancaster, England. And they looked at 200 incidents of violence from surveillance cameras and looked to see how many bystanders were in the area and if they intervened. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that in 9 out of 10 incidents, at least one bystander intervened. Wow. And in most cases, more than one. It was an average of 3.8 people intervening in incidents that ranged just from arguments to violent attacks. And there was no significant difference between the three countries or even the level of crimes.
Wow.
When you actually look at what people do in the real world, what you find is that people do intervene. It is probably true to say that each individual person is less likely to intervene if there are more people around them.
Because they're waiting for somebody else to do it.
But when you increase the number of people, the number of bystanders, what you find is the person who needs help is more likely overall to get help.
Yes.
The individual reduction in the sense of responsibility is outweighed by the increased number of people. This episode was from 2017. So it was before the surveillance camera study had been done. So they didn't have the most up-to-date information, which essentially overturned the bystander effect happening in the real world. But they did already have information that had been done
that it was
in
made, that
the
it was
early
made
2000s.
Up.
First of all, that the Kitty Genovese murder didn't go down at all like the New York Times reported at the time.
Yeah.
But also more recent studies into the bystander effect, including one of the original authors of the Kitty Genovese study, the ones that first of all kicked off the bystander effect and named the bystander effect. He did another study in 1981 and said it basically confirmed his earlier findings. And in 2006, a reanalysis of that study was done. And that was where we got the information that essentially as you increase the group size, you don't get this reduction in likelihood of the person getting assistance.
Yep.
You do get a reduction in each individual rendering that assistance. The original reporting was that the more witnesses, the less likely the person is to end up getting help, which is what Olivia says in this episode. That had, by that point the episode came out, already been overturned by more recent and more robust data. So our final example in this section is from Boston Legal. And this is a rare example of people kind of acknowledging that the thing isn't true, but seeing its value to be used as an argument anyway.
The cell phone?
Evidently, he was talking on it when he got struck by the lightning.
Those studies linking cell phones and lightning have been completely debunked.
Well, the studies have been mainly discounted, but not totally. And conflicting studies, it becomes a question of fact, not law.
Which means the case can't get kicked at summary judgment.
Can I see those studies, please?
So, yeah, as lawyers, they are looking at maybe raising the possibility that the reason this person got struck by lightning could be because they were using a cell phone at the time.
Yeah.
Therefore, maybe had some kind of liability in there because they should have known not to use a cell phone in a lightning storm or something like that. That might have been part of the argument. But one of the paralegals basically raises that the studies haven't been debunked. They've just been kind of questioned and there's conflicting studies. And that means we can raise it. We can still make this argument, and it's worth arguing in court. So studies on whether cell phones are actually a problem in a lightning storm are pretty few and far between, and the experts don't really disagree about it.
Oh, right.
There was a letter written to the British Medical Journal in 2006. It said, "We report the case of a 15-year-old girl who was witnessed being struck by lightning while using her mobile phone in a large park in London during stormy weather. She was successfully resuscitated, but 1 year later she was a wheelchair user with complex physical, cognitive and emotional problems, as well as persistent perforation of the left tympanic membrane." Mm-hmm. And it talks about this case. It says, "To our knowledge, no similar cases have been reported in the medical literature. We found 3 cases reported in China, Korea and Malaysia. All these events resulted in death after the people were struck by lightning while using their mobile phones outside during storms. This rare phenomenon is a public health issue, and education is necessary to highlight the risk of using mobile phones outdoors during stormy weather to prevent future fatal consequences from lightning strike injuries related to mobile phones." So the authors of this letter, who are doctors, are saying, because we've managed to find 4 instances
Yeah.
Of people being struck by lightning while using mobile phones. Yeah. Therefore, it's the mobile phones that yeah. are causing this problem.
Yeah.
And this is a public health issue that needs to be looked into and
yeah.
warn people about. There's a very clear cum hoc ergo propter hoc thing yeah. going on yeah. here. People get struck by lightning.
If you go outside in a storm...
People also use mobile phones.
Yeah.
The fact that it happened while these people were using mobile phones isn't that proof it that was it mobile was the mobile phones yeah. that caused it by
it
any means.
It could be something to do with the fact that they were walking out into a clearer area in order to get a signal.
Could
and
be.
If you then yeah. become the tallest thing in the surrounding thunderstorm area... you're likely to be the path of least resistance for the lightning.
Well, this is the thing, because they finish their letter by saying the Australian Lightning Protection Standard recommends that metallic objects, including cordless or mobile phones, should not be used or carried outdoors during a thunderstorm.
Right.
And there was a response to this letter from another doctor saying the letter in the BMJ had caused worldwide media interest.
Yep.
The US... National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had responded, saying lightning is not attracted to people carrying mobile phones. They said people are struck because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. The
right.
wrong place is anywhere outside. The wrong time is any time a thunderstorm is nearby. Sassy Noah.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah.
And they also pointed out that the claim that the Australian Lightning Protection Standard recommends mobile phones should not be used during storms is incorrect. The standard does not make any such recommendation. It advises people to use mobile phones instead of conventional cordless telephones during storms because conventional phones pose a well-documented
right.
risk. Because phones,
yep.
corded yep. phones, to landlines, are attached to telegraph poles which are big pointy things.
Out. Yeah, with like
and
lightning
liable to get struck by lightning.
By
yeah, yeah. And then metal...
Yeah.
Which
yep.
is attached to those big poles
yep.
is connected to your phone.
Yep.
So, yeah, that is genuinely a danger.
Yep.
It was a low risk, but it was a significantly higher risk than not using
yeah.
it. Mobile phones and cordless landlines
yep.
don't pose any kind of the same risk. Also, lightning isn't attracted to metal.
Yes.
The electricity is conducted by metal.
Yep.
So, if you are touching a metal thing that gets struck by lightning, then that's a problem.
Yeah. Because it works the same way as electricity. It
yeah, yeah.
is electricity.
But trees and telegraph poles and other things like
yeah.
that are regularly struck by lightning
yeah.
because the thing that attracts lightning is pointiness. Tallness and pointiness.
Yeah.
Those are the main things. So if you're the tallest thing in an area, be you a tree, a telegraph pole or a person in a field,
yeah.
you are liable to get struck by lightning if that is where the lightning strikes. The small amount of metal in a cell phone is not going to
no.
increase your chances of getting struck by
yeah,
lightning.
Yeah, and nothing to do with the broadcasting of, or, you know, the reception of radio waves or the broadcasting radio waves. Because
No. Radio has absolutely nothing to do with
the way
where
that
lightning strikes.
Lightning kind of works is that actually lightning always strikes twice because the...
yeah, absolutely.
Things
strikes
ions
the same places
go
all over.
Up from... you, because of the potential difference between the ground and the sky, and that's where it becomes the path of least resistance for the lightning.
Yes.
And so it kind of, it just joins onto
yeah,
that.
And holding a cell phone does not change that at
no.
all.
No.
So the Boston Legal episode was kind of making up the idea that there were all these studies
yeah.
that had then been debunked.
Yeah,
but
turns out.
Even within the fiction of the episode,
yeah.
they were saying... that was true, or that was thought
right.
to be true at some point, but it's since been debunked. But let's argue it anyway.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for Fake News, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Of course, what we should be concentrating on, and only on, is that streak of 10 or so wins in a row that I had, because that's the true measure of how the game
it
should be played.
It was an impressive run.
And is indicative of how something has been going awry ever since.
He did very, very well for a period of time.
Yeah.
Somewhere there, last year sometime.
You just need to go back and look at that.
Yeah. So I kind of had a fake news in mind to do this episode.
Right.
Because Trump spoke at West Point. He did the West Point commencement address.
Yeah.
And he did his old rambling story about a real estate developer who sold his company and lost momentum and went back and went bankrupt and stuff like that. And it was just, it was
right.
pretty, it kind of... it was weird because it was scripted. It was like one of the things he intended to talk about at this commencement address at West Point. God.
Yeah, yeah.
He's talked about it before at the University of Alabama. He told the Boy Scouts about it.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
He
mentions
it from time to time. There were a few rambling things he said, but it was kind of, it was a bit dull. And so today, when something else happened, I thought, actually, this is better. Let's do this. Because today, as we predicted a long time ago, Trump and Elon have really fallen out.
We knew
it couldn't last, their honeymoon. It was always going to be a clash of egos.
Clash of the Titans. Yeah.
Trump was never going to be happy with the amount of press that Elon was getting, and Elon was on so many drugs that he was never going to be really responsible for anything he said in front of Trump, probably.
Yeah.
It was going to come to a head, and today it's kicked off. So, yeah, over the last few days, Elon has been talking about the big, beautiful bill.
The big, ugly
and
bill.
And how it's actually a disgusting abomination. And so when Trump met with German Chancellor Merz in the Oval Office, he was asked about Elon by a reporter. Yeah. And here are some things that he said.
Right.
Statement number one. He knew every aspect of this bill. He knew it better than almost anybody, and he never had a problem until right after he left. And if you saw the statements he made about me, which I'm sure you can get very easily, it's very fresh on tape, he said the most beautiful things about me. And he hasn't said bad about me personally, but I'm sure that'll be next. But I'm very disappointed in Elon. I've helped Elon a lot.
Okay.
Statement number two. You've seen him. Practically everyone has seen him. He was in the Oval, this beautiful Oval Office, which is a lot more beautiful now than it used to be, by the way. We've made some changes, and they've been great. And he looked happy. He was happy with the hats. You saw the hats. But for some reason, he's not so happy now. And if you want the truth, I think maybe he's sad that he's not here anymore. I think that's what it is.
Okay.
And statement number three.
Right.
He's not the first. People leave my administration and they love us. And then at some point they miss it so badly and some of them embrace it and some of them actually become hostile. I don't know what it is. It's sort of Trump derangement syndrome, I guess they call it. But we have it with others too. They wake up in the morning and the glamour's gone, the whole world is different and they become hostile.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm going to... Yeah. Well, here are my the things that triggered me. Very fresh on tape. Just wondering, that's a very specific kind of dated thing that he's likely to have said. But then I'm thinking about the too many beautifuls there. We made some changes. They made it go, he looks at me. It's more beautiful now, by the way, with the hats. But that's so Trump. It could be Trump rather than being so Trump. You've made it up. Too many beautifuls in there. And lots of hats. Okay, I am going to go with number two is the one that you made up.
Okay, so which of the other two are you more convinced by?
More convinced by very fresh on tape, so number one.
Okay, and number one?
Yeah.
Is real.
He knew every aspect of this bill. He knew it better than almost anybody. And he never had a problem until right after he left. And if you saw the statements he made about me, which I'm sure you can get very easily, it's very fresh on tape. He said the most beautiful things about me. And he hasn't said bad about me personally, but I'm sure that'll be next. But I'm very disappointed in Elon. I've helped Elon a lot.
He's helped Elon a lot.
Yeah,
Elon
poor Elon.
$50 million to get him elected.
Much more than that.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, he did help. He sold a couple of cars on the White House lawn, didn't he?
Yeah.
So. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, you helped him a lot. Yeah, helped him out because he was, you know, the whole car thing was tanking.
He said the most beautiful things about me. He hasn't said bad about me personally. He has now.
Yeah.
So when he said, oh, I'm sure that'll be next. Oh, yes. It's really just this afternoon. Lots of stuff has happened. It seems to be still developing. One of the things that Musk said was he tweeted, time to drop the really big bomb. Donald Trump is in the Epstein files. That's the real reason they've not been made public.
Wow. Nice. Yeah.
Trump said that he was thinking about basically cancelling all of Elon's subsidies for Tesla and for SpaceX and all of that kind of stuff. And he said basically, well, I don't know why Biden didn't do it.
Right.
It's the best and quickest way to save money. And then one of Musk's baby mamas, Ashley St. Clair, tweeted to Trump and Musk, let me know if you need any breakup advice.
Excellent.
They're basically going at it and they're attacking each other. Elon said, without me, Trump would have lost the election. Dems would be in control of the House and Republicans would be 51-49 in the Senate.
Yeah.
They're just basically accusing each other of lying and being paedophiles and being awful and being just like, it's all kicking off. So, that's also
number three. Yeah.
And that one, which you think is real.
Yeah.
Is real.
He's not the first. People leave my administration and they love us. And then at some point they miss it so badly and some of them embrace it and some of them actually become hostile. I don't know what it is. It's sort of Trump derangement syndrome, I guess they call it. But we have it with others too. They leave and they wake up in the morning and the glamour's gone. The whole world is different and they become hostile.
It's the glamour. Yeah, it's not that they hated every moment of being in your company and as soon as they leave, they start talking about how shit you were. It's that they miss how great
it was.
They
miss it. Yeah, they miss it so badly. You know, they leave.
Turns them sour.
Even though they love us, and then they miss it because it can't ever be anything to do with Trump. Yeah.
In coming up with number two, I was a little tricksy in as much as because this is plastered all over every social media everywhere.
Right.
I kept it quite close to things he said
around
this subject.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a few, I reworded stuff and I changed, he didn't say this in between those two other things that he said, but he did mention during his meeting with Chancellor Merz that the Oval Office is so much nicer looking now than it was 6 months ago.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he did mention Elon's hats.
No.
He said he thinks he misses it, basically. That's what his theory was as to why Elon
is
being
so angry,
so hostile. It wasn't made up out of whole cloth, but it wasn't a series of sentences that were said by Trump. So we do have some social contestants.
Right.
In Facebook. One of our most recent joiners to the Facebook group, Jeremy.
Yay.
Welcome, Jeremy. He says, finally through the back catalogue and caught up to the current episode, so I feel incredibly unqualified for the game. I read one and was sure it was fake until I read two and then I read three. But three isn't real. I don't think he really says Trump derangement syndrome. There's too many syllables in there to stumble over.
Turns out, though.
Yeah.
You see, that's quite interesting. You've listened to the whole lot and you don't deem yourself to be
If anything, I feel probably the most qualified.
I'm with you, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Anders on Patrons says, if it's not number two Jim made up, I might be inclined to eat Elon's lovely hats unless I become hostile. Richard Thunder Hopkins says, this feels like cheating. Number three is fake news because one and two are all over all my social medias. This is so brilliant and I love it. Best high school breakup ever. So yeah, number two clearly sounded close enough to the stuff that is all over Richard's socials.
Nice, nice, sailing close to the wind.
Yeah. Rene Z said, one and three are the angry real statements. I think he said parts of two in the past, but it seems like you're focusing today on the lovely fight they're having. It gets more exciting by the minute. Scott says, oh wow, one is chock full of hyperbole and contains the requisite word salad. He hasn't said bad about me, huh? So it's plausibly real. Two has the familiar sentence stumps and the expected bragging about all that wretched gold crap in the, what did he call it, oval. I say it's real. Three, on the other hand, must be fake. For one, it contains too many complete sentences. I know the word complete is rather generous here, but hear me out. The tale is him admitting he doesn't know something, so I think Jim made this one up.
I did skirt over that towards it at one point, thinking it was a bit self-aware and a bit low-key. Yeah, no, good work.
One-Eyed Nick says, love to watch a bad guy fight. Hopefully they somehow negate the existence of one another in an aurora borealis of bullshittery, a pea smell drifting away on a puff of hot air. I have no idea which is real and which isn't. They're both saying everything and anything to try to win over the rubes. I want to hear President Poops accused Ketezlamine of having TDS or describe him with the hats. So I'm going for number one is fake.
That is brilliant. That is, yeah. You see, that's the level of derangement we're all suffering right there, described quite beautifully by Nick.
And finally, Kaz Tui says, the end of the bromance. Too bad, so sad. I'm just guessing this week number three is fake.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
And it's time for the part of the show that this week at least is called Pardons Are Still Not a Logical Fallacy, because there's been a flurry, pardons from Trump. This is unusual, basically, because normally the kind of bulk of a president's pardons come in the last months and weeks of their administration, because it's times that they can get away with stuff without people getting too upset. For Obama, for instance, a lot of his commutations that he did, and in some cases pardons, were based on changes in drug laws that meant that a lot of people were still in prison serving sentences had they been convicted of those crimes more recently, those sentences would have been much lower. And so they wouldn't have still been in prison. And so it was making those into more of a fair sentence. And they had a very, very clear and strict policy of people, like, for example, not using violence and things like that in their crimes. That meant that they took it seriously deciding who got commutations or pardons and who didn't.
And they would have also been kind of publicly, not notorious, but people would have known about them in the public realm.
In some cases.
They would see that these were unjust to continue, so they ought to be pardoned. This flurry of Trump's, not necessarily so.
There were certainly arguments that they could make and did make in public about specific cases, and said, you know, this, if this was a conviction that had happened recently, this person would have been out of prison by now anyway. They had a system, they vetted people carefully, and it's almost universal that presidents don't pardon violent criminals.
Right. Yeah.
Where violence is involved, it's that tends to be the thing that's a bright line that people stop at when looking at who to pardon. And they do usually have systems. Obama, up until now, commuted more sentences than other presidents because of the drug thing, because a lot of cases were involved in the changes in the drug sentencing laws. Trump has by far passed Obama in terms of pardons and commutations, largely because of the 1,500-plus people that he pardoned that were connected to January 6th, and many of whom were violent, committed violent offences. But just recently, he has done a new tranche of pardons and commutations. And the thing that kind of links them together is largely either direct connections to Trump himself or money that they have paid him personally, or his proxies, his campaigns or his PACs or his inauguration fund, things like that. And the reason he's doing it now instead of at the end of his term is because he doesn't give a shit about whether people think he's doing the right thing or not, or whether these are genuinely okay to do.
Plus, there are people that will give him money during the presidency because he can't go on the stump and campaign because he can't have a pack.
Yeah.
So he needs money. So these are the people that he's pardoning them, either as a result of them attending a function and giving him some money and buying, therefore, 5 minutes in his ear, or they're going to, in the future, give him some money because he's a mafia don and it's all about quid pro quo.
Absolutely. So there's a list of some of the people that he has pardoned during this administration that have been directly kind of financially beneficial to him. The first on the list is Trevor Milton, who's the founder of the electric vehicle company Nikola. Another link between many of these people is that they committed fraud of various types. He's very into pardoning people who defrauded other people.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, because that's, he can see nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what he's done his entire life. So why are they in jail?
Yeah, so Trevor Milton defrauded investors about the potential of his electric vehicle company. He donated nearly $2 million to the campaign last year, Trump's campaign, including $920,000 to the Trump 47 PAC. And he got a pardon for his 2022 conviction of federal crimes. For defrauding investors, that's fine.
Yeah.
Imad Zuberi, Trump commuted the sentence of this guy who's a venture capitalist and major political donor. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison for violating campaign finance and tax laws and for obstructing an investigation into Trump's 2017 inaugural committee.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So,
Because Trump didn't want that looked into.
That's right. And, you know, and what's a little bit of campaign finance violation between felons? Yes.
He donated at least $800,000 to committees associated with Trump and the Republican Party. Michelle Fiore, who was a Nevada Republican, I think we talked about her before because she raised money supposedly for a statue for a police officer who was killed. And then didn't put up a statue. And everyone was like, well, where the fuck is this statue? And she'd spent the money on just general shit that she was doing, including her daughter's wedding. And of course, she was imprisoned for that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no, she was convicted and she was awaiting sentencing. And so Trump pardoned her. So now she won't be sentenced.
Mainly because she did lots of supporting of Trump.
She endorsed Trump in 2016.
Is there no recourse of action against this outrageous behaviour on his part?
There isn't, because the pardon power is specifically exclusive to the president. And so under the Supreme Court immunity ruling, that's one of the things that they were absolutely very clear.
Presidential stuff.
There's literally no one he can pardon apart from possibly himself. That hasn't been tested. That would be something that, that a court could raise an issue with. There's nothing that could be done about it. In fact, if he specifically and openly, like on camera, took bribes to give someone a pardon, arguably the bribery could be prosecuted, but the pardon would still have to stand. If you bribed someone to get someone out of prison, which we'll come to in a second.
In a moment.
If you specifically bribed Trump to get, say, your son out of prison, even if that bribery was investigated and someone went to prison for it, or there was some kind of fallout for that, then the pardon would still stand and the person would not then be convicted of that crime. So... that's fucked
basically
up.
This is the papacy of the Borgias, isn't it?
It's
just, you know, they've got, he's got to the highest office in the land and he's just saying, well, I could do it, and he's changed the rules so that he can just do anything.
There were rumors in the first administration, there was reporting that Giuliani was touting pardons for cash. He was kind of offering people, you know, he was telling people how much it would cost to get a pardon out of Trump.
Right.
This time, it's super fucking clear that that's exactly what's happening. Weirdly, he also pardoned Devin Archer and Jason Galanis. Now, they were Hunter Biden's business partners, which does seem like that would be strange, and why would he do that? I think a large part of the reason is because Devin Archer testified against Hunter Biden.
Right.
And so he sees...
Yes, kind of, they were the ones that the enemy supposedly did situation. The same thing that Hunter Biden did. And so if you pardon them for their part in it, they can then come back out and have another go at Hunter Biden?
Maybe.
Or is it doing it in kind of retaliation for Joe Biden pardoning Hunter Biden for any future...
I don't know. I think partly it's another fraud thing. They defrauded the Ogallala Sioux. I think it was an oil deal.
Yeah, that's right. Yes,
So maybe it's just, you know, solidarity with other fraudsters.
With other fraudsters.
Yeah, that could be it. Oh,
man.
Yeah, he pardoned...
Who has put these names in front of him?
That's a good question. One of the answers to that is Ed Martin, who was originally supposed to be the US Attorney General.
Right.
That got withdrawn because he was shit and hated by everyone.
Completely fucking corrupt.
And now, he's working in the White House and working. Part of his remit is on pardons. He has talked about pardoning people who are involved in fake elector schemes, not just the ones around the 2020 election, but right. also the like people in history, people like who were accused, like in Hawaii, for example, of running fake elector schemes on Kennedy's behalf and things like that. Because it theoretically creates a precedent in a way. If you say, well, they didn't commit any crimes in 1960, then therefore the people who did it for Trump in 2020 also didn't commit any crimes.
Right.
In a way. It's bizarre.
Wow.
But yeah, that's something he suggested. That's also
1984 fiction novel
stuff. Yeah. He's also suggested pardoning the people who were convicted for conspiring to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer.
Right.
He's not great. He's an asshole. So that he's one of the guys who is pushing various people who Trump is happily signing their pardons and commutations for.
Wow. Wow. On the understanding that there will be some quid pro quo happening.
There'll be some. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Todd and Julie Chrisley, who are apparently reality TV stars, at least on basic cable,
right.
a show called Chrisley Knows Best, they were sentenced to a combined 19 years in prison for fraud and tax evasion.
Yeah.
Their daughter, Savannah, spoke for Trump basically at the Republican National Convention and has repeatedly been seen at the White House and kind of speaking to Trump and campaigning for her parents to be pardoned. So that happened.
Yeah. So it's happened,
yeah. Probably.
Kind of, how rich are they? Kind of thing.
They're super rich.
Yeah.
Especially after all the fraud. Probably the most blatant is Paul Woolsack, who was a Florida businessman who committed tax crimes, tax fraud.
Oh, yes.
Pleaded guilty to it. Yep. He withheld more than $10 million from his employees' paychecks and spent that on himself. He bought a $2 million yacht.
It's another Baroness Monet job, isn't it? Got this PPE contract and then buy a yacht.
Part of his sentence was 18 months in prison, and another part was $4 million in restitution, which would go to the victims of his crimes, who he stole $10 million from. So it's not even that much. It's like they get almost half their money back. But Woolsack's mother, Elizabeth Fargo, has donated millions of dollars to Trump's presidential campaigns.
Yeah,
she donated, in fact, was it a month before or 2 months before the pardon? She donated $1 million to a PAC connected to Trump.
Yeah.
And so Trump pardoned Paul, her son.
Yeah.
Which means that he doesn't have to pay the $4 million in restitution. So the people he stole money from don't get anything back. They don't get that. And on an investment of $1 million, the Woolsack family save $4 million.
Well, nine if he stole
He stole 10. But he was that six, that was his. He got to keep that no matter what happened. You know, bullseye rules, that's yours to go home
that's
with.
That's safe, yeah. Does he get to keep the yacht?
Presumably.
Yeah.
That's unbelievably fucked up and extreme. It couldn't be clearer that that's why Trump pardoned him.
Oh, yeah.
There was a sheriff in Culpeper County, Scott Howard Jenkins.
Yep.
He received $75,000 of bribes as cash and campaign contributions from numerous individuals who he then appointed to positions. He was convicted of conspiracy to commit bribery.
With doing that,
And sentenced to 20 months in prison. But because he also supported Trump, he was pardoned one day before he was set to report to federal prison. Incidentally, Ed Martin, who I previously mentioned, after the pardon came through for Jenkins, tweeted, "No MAGA left behind," which is very much saying the quiet part out loud. It couldn't be more clearly saying, if you are on our side, we will do these things for you.
I thought that was somebody, you know, being ironic or pointing out in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, "No MAGA left behind."
No,
it's actually the guy who's...
the guy who's running these things. Yeah. And finally, Brian Kelsey, a former Republican Tennessee state senator. Again, a campaign finance fraud. He repeatedly accused the Biden administration of weaponizing the Justice Department and donated $15,000 to the Trump 47 pack and got pardoned by Trump.
And didn't he also say, "God used Donald Trump to save me from the weaponized Biden DOJ and thereby weaponizing God"? That's God's on our side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you commit crimes but are also Republican, and especially if you're a rich Republican who donates money to Trump.
Mind you, 15,000 compared really with 15,000,
yeah, that's not much. But he was vocally pro-Trump throughout all of that, and that's really what matters.
Yeah, yeah.
Any combination of giving him lots of money or saying he's great are likely to get you off, especially if your crimes are fraud-related.
Fraud, yeah.
Yeah, that seems to really help.
Fraud with sycophancy and several thousand dollars, tens of thousands at the very least. Wow, you've got to sell your soul and give some money to the devil, who God is using to save you from the weaponized Department of Justice.
It's all good.
My God. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, a.k.a. Mickey Rourke reflected in the back of a spoon, has criticised part of the one big beautiful bill we talked about recently, which is a bit rich because she voted for it. But in her defence, she didn't actually read it before she voted for it. I should clarify, that's her speaking in her own defence. Full transparency, I did not know about this section on pages 278 to 279 of the OBBB that strips states of the right to make laws or regulate AI for 10 years, she tweeted. I am adamantly opposed to this, and it is a violation of state rights, and I would have voted no if I had known that it was in there. It could be argued, as Eric Swalwell did, that reading the fucking bill before voting for it was her only job. But she was pretty sure voting for it would own the Libs, so why bother reading it? Another aspect of the bill that was hidden away in the fine print on page 562 of over 1,000 pages is a provision to prevent courts from enforcing contempt orders on, for example, hypothetical presidents who send people to El Salvadoran prisons and then defy court orders telling them to bring them back. MTG's Republican colleague Mike Flood from Nebraska was booed by voters at a town hall when he told them, "I'm not going to hide the truth. This provision was unknown to me when I voted for that bill." I'm sure as the bill works its way through the Senate, there'll be no such slacking off. But even when the GOP senators vote for their own bastardised version, one person will definitely read it. Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough. It's her non-partisan job to make sure everything in the bill is in keeping with the Byrd rule, which bars the Senate from including any extraneous provisions in budget bills. Basically, according to the rule, if a policy provision doesn't have an effect on the budget, it can't be included. Even budget changes that are merely incidental to policy provisions are considered out of order. Given that leaving AI unregulated for 10 years and letting people get away with contempt of court are not necessary to implement the budget reconciliation goals of the bill, it seems likely those provisions won't make it into the final version.
Everywhere you go, right, you come across AI, not just the ones you go to deliberately use it. It sits in Microsoft Outlook like the old animated paperclip asking if you want help pre-seeing the email you just received. It sits in Google giving you a summary of all the websites listed as a summary already of the available links to your search query. It sits in Bing inviting you to make a picture based on your words. All of them have a disclaimer that states AI-generated content may contain mistakes. Even Musk's Grok admitted to that. So like all diligent undergraduates, we make sure, don't we, that the stuff we use to cut and paste wholesale from Wikipedia, in my day from the latest edition of the Philosophical Review magazine in the library, and now get AI to generate from all the stuff that's been bunged on the interwebs like so much trash into a dumpster, we make sure we read it, double-check it, even rewrite it to make it sound like us and not that we've just copied and pasted it, etc., etc. There are even tools in the AI arms race used by college professors and public holding government to accounters to check the AI-generatedness of written work. ChatGPT, etc., leaves little invisible markers in text they generate, which can be read by such tools and assess the percentage of AI-generatedness of the shit you've just shoveled onto paper. Unsurprising, then, that when the most underqualified undergrad medical student RFK Jr. and his ma-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha crowd produced a Make America Healthy Again report that cited hundreds of studies which decried America's food supply, pesticides and prescription drugs, Notice.org found that some of those studies did not actually exist. And the Washington Post reports that experts found that scientific citations in the report were generated by AI. Some citations included OAI site attached to the URLs. That's OpenAI's marker for stuff it generates. George C. Benjamin of the American Public Health Association in this scenario is your professor, undergrad Kennedy Jr., and he says this is not an evidence-based report and for all practical purposes it should be junked at this point. It cannot be used for any policy making. It cannot even be used for any serious discussion because you can't believe what's in it. The problem is that far from being sent down from college and told never to return, it is fundamentally RFK Jr.'s entire raison d'etre. We know we can't believe anything that comes out of RFK Jr., except maybe that worm. So why bother even going through anything he's written in support of himself? After all, fascist Barbie Caroline Leavitt said it was backed on good science, which isn't even spoken on good English.
Being the president is a hard job. Even being a shit president isn't easy, and Trump fails at the most basic aspects of that on a daily basis. So imagine if your job was to get him to read the president's daily brief. It's an important document that includes highly classified intelligence analysis, information about covert operations, and reports from the most sensitive US sources or those shared by allied intelligence agencies. The PDB allows the president to make life or death decisions on complex domestic and foreign policy issues, and it's what prevents him from looking like an uninformed fuckwit when he gets intelligent questions from the press, foreign dignitaries, or government officials. Politico reported last week that Trump has sat for 12 presentations of the president's daily brief since taking office, which explains the fuckwittery somewhat, since, as the name suggests, they're supposed to be daily. There's also a written briefing document, but Trump doesn't read that either, even if you write it in bullet points and include his name at least once on every page like they did in the first administration. So Tulsi Gabbard, whose job it is to keep him informed about stuff, since she's the Director of National Intelligence, has been trying to think of ways to present the information so that he'll pay attention. Personally, I'd make an AI version of Trump himself, alternating between reading intelligence reports and rambling anecdotes about Arnold Palmer's dick, because I reckon Trump spends quite a lot of his time just re-watching his old rallies. But Tulsi's come up with a pretty good idea too. According to NBC, one idea that has been discussed is to transform the PDB so it mirrors a Fox News broadcast, according to four of the people with direct knowledge of the discussions. Under that concept, as it has been discussed, the National Intelligence Director's Office could hire a Fox News producer to produce it and one of the network's personalities to present it. Trump, an avid Fox News viewer, could then watch the broadcast PDB whenever he wanted. Sure, it's not great that you have to trick the president into doing his job by wrapping information in a piece of cheese and hoping he accidentally swallows some, but whatever works, I guess.
The person in charge fails to demonstrate knowledge of food safety. The inspector noted in May, amid the volume and severity of the violations, which is a violation in and of itself under the health code. Who do you think that was and where? Yep. Trump, being correct. White House kitchen, how dare you? You simply need to watch the residents to understand that the incumbent POTUS is merely tolerated on the premises and is allowed nothing to do with the running of the dining in any way. No, it's the exclusive National Golf Club in Bedminster, membership of which Trump describes as an investment in life, luxury and leisure, touting its top amenities and services. Things that irked the Somerset County Department of Health included non-compliance with all three requirements in the food protective and contamination category, with violations including expired milk, raw meat stored improperly, and a dishwasher that maxed out 170 degrees when the minimum required for commercial premises is 180. The club receives a score of 32 out of 100 possible points, with the inspector documenting 18 violations, 9 of which were deemed critical, meaning they may result in an unacceptable health risk. You'd think the cleanest of areas, the bathrooms, would be fine, surely, but no, unless you count storing a sanitizer bucket in one as a guarantee of cleanliness. This is a man who stored secret government documents in the John, so what are you going to do? I tell you what are the inspectorate going to do. They issue the club a conditionally satisfactory C grade and required them to display a placard with the grade in a visible location. The conditions were somewhat met with a snap inspection in June when the club earned a B grade with a score of 86, the lowest score possible to still receive that grade. The inspector documented 6 violations, including 2 categorised as critical. Keep an eye on the dismantling of the Department of Health's public inspectorate anytime soon. but be sure that the initial membership fee of $350,000 a year is not going to change at Bedminster.
According to a recently released federal ethics disclosure, Trump's border czar Tom Homan was paid an undisclosed fee working as a consultant for Geo Group for 2 years before he joined the administration in January. It's probably just a coincidence that Geo Group is one of two companies running the vast majority of for-profit immigrant detention facilities, and Homan is calling for a massive increase in the immigrant detention system, which he says needs at least 100,000 beds, more than double the 41,500 currently in ICE's budget. While arrests have increased since January, actual deportations have stayed fairly level, which means all those detainees are going into private US facilities, many of which are run by Geo Group, who, incidentally, donated $500,000 to Trump's inauguration fund this year. Not happy with current rates, Stephen Miller and Christy Noem have pressed immigration officials to nearly double their quotas and arrest up to 3,000 people per day, which has led agencies to instruct ICE officers to get creative with ways to increase arrests and suggest them to superiors. If it involves handcuffs on wrists, it's probably worth pursuing, said one email seen by The Guardian. I'm sure it's just about the rule of law, though, and not blatant money-grubbing corruption, even though they are now regularly arresting people with no criminal history and targeting people who are attending citizenship hearings because that's the quick way to round up non-citizens.
Dinesh D'Souza's go-to FBI whistleblower slash informant slash grass slash unqualified whinger, who featured large in police state, talking about how the US was a police state and how when he pointed that out, he was no longer welcome in the FBI and other made-up fucking nonsense, Dan Bongino, finally got his dream job. You'd think he's the Bureau's deputy director, poacher, turned gamekeeper, revolutionary, overthrowing the ruling class and getting to run things his way, you'd figure. Nah, he's had to stop podcasting about how bad things have been and it's all Biden's fault and how Trump has fixed everything, even though police state was made about the state of America when Trump was in charge. Yeah, whatever. He's had to stop taking to the airwaves and he's had to start taking a lunchbox into the office. He appeared last week on Fox News lamenting about how unhappy he's become now that he's the Bureau's deputy director, complaining that he gave up everything to take the job. Part of what he's given up is possibly the money-making aspect of making stuff up for your MAGA audience, as he and his boss Kash Patel made a fairly astonishing plea to the MAGA faithful during their joint appearance on Fox News. Stop expecting Hillary Clinton to be arrested for murdering Jeffrey Epstein, they stressed, because Epstein killed himself. Which, of course, prompted right-wing conspiracists to hammer them for failing to keep their promise to expose the truth about his death, especially since both Patel and Bongino had helped promote those very conspiracies around Epstein. I'm just telling you what we see in the file, he declared. I want to be crystal clear on this. I'm not asking anyone to believe me. I'm just telling you what is there and what isn't. Wailing, I miss me too, when told that one woman misses him and his show, Bongino added, part of you dies when you see this stuff behind the scene. Yeah, the making shit up part. Just ask former mystical QAnon arch conspiracy theorist whose glory came crashing down when he eschewed anonymity by revealing his very normal Ron Watkins name. And I, for one, Dan Bongino, would plead with you to stop whining about it, because I'm laughing so hard it's beginning to hurt. No, just stop, please.
Trump's tariffs are finally making American automakers take a good hard look at how they do business and change where their vehicles are assembled. Ford, for example, shut down production of the Explorer in their Chicago plant for a week in May because of a shortage of necessary parts. They, along with three other major car companies, are considering shifting some production to China as a direct result of Trump's brilliantly thought out and not at all shit tariffs. As part of the totally arbitrary trade war started by Trump, China has started requiring companies to get permission to export magnets made with rare earth metals such as dysprosium and terbium. Those magnets are used in electric vehicle motors as well as windshield wipers, headlights and other important car parts. China controls 90% of the world's supply of these metals, and their unwillingness to export them is causing global shortages. But they are very happy to allow exports of assembled car parts, which include the magnets. So regardless the level of Trump's tariffs, it's becoming better for business to export your motor to China, have them assemble it, and import it back in to put into a car, a process which was previously done in a US factory. The alternative is to go back to less efficient, more expensive, older technology which doesn't use the magnets, or strip premium features like adjustable seats out of American cars, making them less attractive to consumers. Well done, Trump, you fucking idiot.
Over here in Britain, in what feels like a tacit admission that they must have done that, then surely, Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride said the Conservatives will never again put the UK's economic stability at risk by making promises we cannot afford. In a speech, he thus disowned Truss's £45 billion package of tax cuts, which spooked financial markets and led to the former Tory PM's resignation in 2022, saying mistakes were recognised and acknowledging the damage to our credibility is not so easily undone. Which is odd, because that implies the mistakes they made were easily undone, or even just undone. There's still the £22 billion black hole in the economy that Rachel Reeves is slashing formerly left-wing things like disability benefits and winter heating allowances as a result of, and this week added to those PR disasters by saying not every government department will get everything they want in the upcoming spending review. And of course, her goddamn position on ruling out borrowing for day-to-day spending and not raising taxes again fuels speculation that spending cuts will be made. I don't get why tax and spend is such a bad position to avoid. I know it was the criticism levelled by the Tories for 14 years, but let's just assume that was one of the mistakes they recognised and vote through tax surcharges on multimillionaires with a massive Commons majority or something. Meanwhile, out on the irrelevant fringes of an increasingly irrelevant Tory party, Liz Truss said she had a plan to turbocharge the economy and accused Mel Stride of bowing to failed Treasury orthodoxy. And Zia Yusuf resigned as the chairman of Reform UK, saying working to get the party elected was no longer a good use of my time. Earlier, Yusuf had criticised Sarah Pochin, who won last month's Runcorn and Helsby by-election, for urging Keir Starmer to ban the burqa in the interests of public safety during her Prime Minister's Questions debut on Wednesday. Yusuf said it was dumb for a party to ask the PM if they would do something the party itself wouldn't do. In response to Yusuf quitting, Pochin said he had been a great friend and colleague, adding that the professionalisation he brought to Reform UK will have a lasting legacy. Well, it's certainly not done that till now. And recently expelled former Reform MP Rupert Lowe said, "The question is, how did a man with no political experience be given such vast power within Reform?" Probably the same way as all the others.
Probably, yeah.
Is my guess.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or simply tell one other person in person about how much they like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our strawman level patrons Chuck Gray, Mike Smith, LT, Colleen Laiela, Richard Thunder Hopkins, Will M, Scott, Mark Reike, and Amber R. Buchanan, who told us when we met her at QED, we can just call her Amber, and last year at QED I met the listener who recognised her at QED the year before, because we keep using her full name all the time. And our true Scotsman level patrons Renee Zed, Melissa Sitek, Stephen Bickle, Janet Uetta, Andrew Houck, and our top patron Kaz Tui. Thank you so much for your patronage, everybody. It really is very much appreciated. Thank you.
You can connect with those awesome people, as well as us and other listeners, in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump, or in the Discord at fallacioustrump.com/discord.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, "We worked together, we did a good job."
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.